This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Hey, I'm Greg from Toronto.
I'm Claire from Pittsburgh.
I'm Lee from Fargo, North Dakota.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Comedians are like flowers. Some of them are sunflowers. Everyone likes sunflowers. They work pretty much everywhere. But even a great sunflower is, you know, pretty good. I mean, it's a sunflower. How great can it be? Maria Bamford, though. Maria Bamford is not a sunflower.
I think I may be the orchid of comedy, where you have to have this, you know, certain temperature in the room and then get the right amount of moisture. And it takes years to really get a bloom going. But once you do, they're so beautiful. Oh, it's got too hot.
It's Bullseye. This week, Maria Bamford talks about the kind of friends who can make your depression even worse.
I talked to my spiritual advisor, and he said people who commit suicide, that sometimes they just need to go on to the next level, the next world. And so I guess I've just come in to say goodbye.
Okay, you're horrible.
She's just released her new stand-up special, The Special Special Special. But first, I talked to the writer George Saunders. He reveals some of his early creative challenges.
I can remember very clearly when I was in college having fairly sophisticated literary insights and not being able to say them. Feeling that there's something luminous that I have access to in feeling, but in terms of speech, I don't have it yet.
And how he solved them. All this week on Bullseye. Let's go. Every week on Bullseye, we're joined by some of our favorite culture critics to recommend pop culture that is worth your time. This week, we're talking about comics with Alex Zalbin from MTV Geek and Brian Heater, comics columnist for Boing Boing. Hey, guys.
Hey, Jesse.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, listen, Alex, we don't usually talk about traditional superhero comics, the old, you know, spandex and superpowers type situation, but your recommendation on today's show is a traditional superhero comic. It's called Hawkeye, Volume 1, My Life as a Weapon. Tell me, is this something that people might like if they're, you know, not deeply steeped in the world of superhero comics?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I think Marvel is doing particularly well right now is allowing writers and artists to have their own voice, even in the realm of superhero comics. You know, certainly you have fisticuffs and you have people dressed up in colorful costumes, but the whole pitch of Hawkeye, written by Mike Fraction, is that it's what this guy who's on the Avengers does on his days off. So there's an issue where he's rewiring his DVR or he's just hanging out at a barbecue, things like that, which doesn't sound like it would be exciting, but it's extremely wittily written by Fraction and, oh, I'm going to mispronounce his name, but David Aja or Aja draws it beautifully. And actually the art is, I think, closer to a Chris Ware than traditional superhero comics. It's definitely my favorite thing that's coming out of Marvel right now. And even if you don't know anything about Hawkeye, the recap is usually he's an Avenger. This is his days off. That's all you need to know.
I'm looking at it now, and the aesthetics of it are really quite beautiful. It's certainly not what you would expect from the traditional kind of, you know, reproduced by Lichtenstein color panel comic look.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's all Aja's art, but working really well with Fraction. You know, Fraction gives him scripts that lend to a very different panel layout, to a very different look, to something that is much more real world than roided out heroes punching each other all the time. You know, there's an issue that came out recently where it was 7 days in the life of Hawkeye, but it was told entirely out of order and sometimes changed halfway through the day. But by the end, it really just illuminated kind of what a regular week would be like in a superhero. And it's not all end of the world stuff. Sometimes it's just making a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or hanging out with your protege.
Brian, let's talk about a comic called Don't Go Where I Can't Follow by Anders Nilsson. This was originally published in a very limited edition in 2006. It's just been republished. And it is the story of a six-year relationship between the author and a partner and the illness that brought it to an end. What do you like about this book?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear once you get into it why it was in limited edition. It's certainly one of the most personal comics that I've ever read. And I went into it. This is probably for the best. I went into it not really knowing what to expect. I mean, I'm a big fan of Anders Nilsson's work. You know, he's kind of an indie comic superstar. You know, it's not really a comic per se for most of it. You know, there's not a lot of panels. There's not a lot of sequential storytelling throughout. It starts off with a lot of letters between the two of them as they're kind of forming the relationship. And then, you know, as you said, takes a pretty sad turn and is kind of about the end of their relationship and the end of her life. Really, you know, really, really touching. It certainly got one of the largest emotional reactions out of me that I've ever gotten from a comic before.
It's told, as you sort of alluded to, in the form of a pastiche of different forms, including actual literal documents of this relationship, stuff like postcards and journal entries. Is that part of its power?
Well, you know, obviously it's filtered through Anders's viewpoint for the most part. But I mean, it really is, you know, his partner gets co-writing credit because, you know, really about half of what you see in there is from her. And it's really it's a dialogue between the two of them, you know, in the form of postcards and actual letters. And I think that probably gives you more insight into the relationship than you ever possibly could get from just a comic.
Brian Heater, a comics columnist for Boing Boing, recommends Don't Go Where I Can't Follow by Anders Nilsson. And Alex Zalbin from MTV Geek recommends Hawkeye Volume 1, My Life as a Weapon. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest George Saunders graduated from the Colorado School of Mines. In his 20s, while he was working in the mineral industry in Sumatra, he realized he didn't want to be a geologist. He wanted to be a writer. That decision, I have to say, has worked out pretty well for him. His short stories and essays earned him a MacArthur Genius Grant a few years ago, and I can verify, having read some of his books, that genius is a fair thing to call him. His stories are often about people who live without self-awareness in a world that's maybe half a step more grotesque than ours. They try to maintain some sense of dignity as they blunder through a life warped by the downsides of capitalism. People work in theme parks as costume characters and as pharmaceutical test subjects. They import third world girls to be their lawn ornaments. It's really kind of sad and really, really funny. His newest book of short stories is 10th of December. George Saunders, welcome back to the show. It's
nice
great
to be
have you
again,
here.
Jesse. Thanks for having me.
I read some interviews that you've done along your book tour trail thus far, and you've been describing yourself as having had a period of relative happiness. Not that you were Mr. Sad Man before.
Not so much, yeah.
But maybe you could describe sort of the place that you were in your life when you wrote this book.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of our kids were in high school and then in college. And so partly it was just this feeling like, you know, we had done well. They're great, great people. And so, you know, my stuff is always pretty dark. It's not not by design, but just kind of that's where I can get traction. If I start something on kind of the worst day or the, you know, in an office, it's the worst manifestation of corporatism or something. So that's not really a mission statement, but it's just what I have to do to get any momentum going. But in this one, I just found myself getting to places where the sort of auto response would be to let the baby go over the cliff, you know, or let the bad thing happen. And just aesthetically, it was more interesting to kind of pause and go, well, wait a minute now. Is it the case that things are always rotten? No, it's not. So therefore, is there any way we could reflect that realization aesthetically? So it was both kind of a personal realization, but also aesthetically, you know, you have to kind of keep turning in a way that's new. And in this book, at certain places, the new turn was one that was towards maybe like opening the possibilities up or something like that. So
you wrote your first book while you were still working as a technical writer. And a lot of your writing has that feeling of the kind of odd terseness that an office memo has.
Yeah.
I wonder if like being immersed in that is still something that you think about sometimes when you're writing sentences of literary.
Well, a lot when I'm asleep, I have the dream, you know, the dream of going back to that office and they've changed the operating systems on the computer and everybody's vaguely snotty, like, oh, Mr. Writer, oh, you're back. How nice for you. Well, we don't really have anything for you at this time. So that it's still real to me. But I think that was a big moment for me because I come to writing maybe from a I was an engineering student and I grew up in Chicago. I didn't know any other writers. So I came to it with the kind of the usual set of assumptions that someone who's from without that word has, which are writing is about being more articulate than you could ever be in real life, and that writing literature was a thing that I could maybe do for 3 minutes a day if I was lucky, you know, that kind of reverence and stuff. And then for me, a big turning point was when I realized that literature actually is just whatever language happens to be like in your culture at that moment, in all its million forms, turning towards that with a little attentiveness and maybe cranking up the volume on that mode of discourse by 20%. So that means that it's, you know, interestingly, that whatever you hear, that has to be the seeds of literature. So if you're in a corporation and maybe your first instinct is to sneer at the memos, but then, you know, the artist in you should go, wait a minute, maybe not. You know, maybe any diction that you overflow is poetry.
You have two different stories in this collection where the protagonist, who is profoundly inarticulate, is administered articulateness drugs.
Yes.
One of them works in a sort of medieval times type context. That is the theme restaurant, Medieval Times.
Right, right.
And is administered a drug that makes them able to be medievally.
Yeah, it's called nightlife.
So what do you like about the difference between someone being inarticulate and then transforming them into hyper-articulate?
Maybe it's the autobiographical.
That's right. I was sincerely wondering, like, is it part of it just you sitting there and feeling like, oh, I'm a dummy, and then I wish there was a switch I could turn that would turn me into a magical literary
guy? It's kind of two things. It's one that I can remember very clearly when I was in college having fairly sophisticated literary insights and not being able to say them, feeling that there is something luminous that I have access to in feeling, but in terms of speech, I don't have it yet. And then when I started reading more and I went to Syracuse and started studying, you know, that magical thing happens where as you put language into yourself that's sophisticated, suddenly your ability to express yourself improves. So that, in a sense, that's kind of, you know, the life story. But the other part of it is, in some of the earlier books, one of the things I reflexively did was to just sort of dumb myself down a bit. So the narrator might be, say, whatever, 40% less articulate than I could be if I had to be. In a sense, it was just like, how do I excuse that in narratively? How do I get myself to go from maybe a 6 to a 9 on my own personal articulate scale? And in this case, it was just, oh, give him a drug, you know. So then it's interesting that your aesthetic boredoms and inclinations, your aesthetic restlessness will often lead you to thematic things that you wouldn't have thought of out of the context.
There's a bit in this in the book that I was hoping that you could read. It's the beginning of this story called The Semplica Girl Diaries. And it's not business talk. It is much more personal than that. But I think it's a really good example of the way that you pinch language, like sticking your thumb over the opening of a garden hose or something like that.
Yeah, because the joke here is that this is a diary entry of a young father or a middle-aged father, and so he's kind of doing that thing we all do in diaries, which is omit articles and kind of trimming it. So this is just the entry for September 3rd. Having just turned 40, have resolved to embark on grand project of writing every day in this new black book just got at Office Max. Exciting to think how in 1 year, at rate of one page per day, we'll have written 365 pages. And what a picture of life and times then available for kids and grandkids, even great-grandkids, whoever, all are welcome to see how life really was, is now. Because what do we know of other times, really? How clothes smelled and carriages sounded? Will future people know, for example, about sound of airplanes going over at night, since airplanes by that time passé? Will future people know sometimes cats fought in night? Because by that time some chemical invented to make cats not fight. Last night dreamed of two demons having sex and found it was only two cats fighting outside window. Will future people be aware of concepts of demons? Will they find our belief in demons quaint? Will windows even exist? Interesting to future generations that even sophisticated college grad like me sometimes woke in cold sweat, thinking of demons, believing one possibly under bed. Anyway, what the heck, I'm not planning on writing encyclopedia. If any future person is reading this, if you want to know what a demon was, go look it up in something called an encyclopedia, if you even still have those. I'm getting off track, due to those fighting cats. We'll write 20 minutes a night, no matter how tired.
This story is about a dad. He's a bit of a sad dad, a classic sad dad. And I wonder if you have ever felt – and he's partly sad because he feels the sort of economic pressure of living in a – you know, in a capitalist context where some people, other families are richer than his family and he's embarrassed for his kids. He doesn't know how to protect his kids from that. I wonder if you've ever felt that way yourself as a dad.
Oh, yeah. Like from 1988 until present. Yeah. No, my wife and I were kind of madly in love and just, let's go for it. You know, we didn't have any money. So, And one of the early things I realized about myself was that if I wanted to have any longevity as a writer, I couldn't go the starving artist route, especially with a family. It would be too stressful and worrisome. So I thought, I'll just start working, you know. So I got a tech writing job. And, it didn't pay that well. And so we were never really hurting, but we always felt that, that the kids would go to school and there'd be people who were going on exotic vacations and people who had that kind of ease that money affords you, you know. And so it was just that slight pressure, you know, that feeling that a race, you know, that, okay, high school's coming. We want to make sure to have just enough to be able to sort of pass, you know. So, and I think part of what you do as a writer is you take those little small inclinations, totally workable, no big deal, but then you just exaggerate them some percentage. And in this case, one of the things that we did, and my wife had been married once before and had money, so she said, you know what people do who have money? They take their kids on vacation every year to the same spot, you know. And I said, well, we can't afford it. And she's really wise. And she said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to pretend we can. So we had credit cards, like out-of-control credit cards. And we sort of simulated this life that was pretty great, you know. And then, paid them off and it was fine. So I think part of the thing was to kind of...
You're describing to me, you say that your wife is wise in coming up with this plan.
No, it worked.
Sounds like a horrible plan.
No, it worked because, you know, with writing, you get little bursts of money, you know. So we had kind of a funny thing whenever we were doing the bills, we'd kind of look at each other and she'd just go, well, it takes money to make money, which totally, you know, as we were spending ourselves...
You were investing in vacations.
We were investing in the future. But it was, you know, so all of it was workable and fine. But as a writer, when I turn to that material, it's interesting to me. Maybe because it was like the dominant narrative of the last 20 years or 30 years of my life. This idea that there's pressure, there's capitalism plunders the sensuality of the body, said Terry Eagleton. And so, most of us who are somewhat high functioning, it's fine. You know, you're not starving, but I think one of the maybe underwritten qualities of American life is that constant quiet pressure. That, you know, the saying you could fail. In my experience, it permeates every aspect of your life. You know, even and it's funny because even if you're doing well, it permeates. You know, if there's a wolf at the door, even if you're warm and cozy, you're aware of the wolf. And if the wolf eats your neighbor, you hear it, you know, and you can say, well, he should have worked a little harder. He should have worked smarter. But, you know, as his cries go out into the night, there's no way that doesn't affect your well-being.
More with George Saunders after a break. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. MaximumFun.org is proud to present BoatParty.biz, a website with a picture of a boat and a place to type in your email address. Online at BoatParty.biz. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest George Saunders is a short story writer and a MacArthur Genius Grant winner. His stories are funny, sometimes brutal, and explore stripped-down versions of modern society. His new collection is called 10th of December. This story, the Sempica Girl story, is the protagonist, the dad in this story, suddenly wins $10,000 in the lottery.
Yeah.
Which is a really particular amount of money. I mean, I remember stopping on it when I heard that he read $10,000. Mm-hmm. It's $10,000. That's the amount of money that is a lot of money, but at the same time, not enough money to really do something change something.
Especially after taxes. Yeah. Now, you know, it's funny because I wrote that story. It started in 98, actually, and kind of got stuck. And I wrote that part about him winning the lottery. And then I swear, 6 months later, our next-door neighbors in Syracuse won the $10 million lottery. So, and it looked like, wow, that was, you know, did I somehow, I caused that. I should have caused it closer to home. But no, that's an amount of money that if you don't have any, you think, oh, yes, we made it. And I think everyone, you know, it's funny. People's inclination, whenever they get any good luck, is to accept it as their due. You know, they earned it. And also to overestimate the effect it'll have. So I think that's one of the things that in the story that he does. He could have done some really smart, practical things with it, but he doesn't because he kind of thinks he thinks that's kind of the what's the word, the praise or the kind of what is the word, praise? He thinks it's the something.
Well, I think you said it was what's due him. I mean,
right.
He thinks it's the universe coming back around.
Like, it's the approval he's always been waiting for.
Yeah.
And of course, it's not. It's just a small amount of money that he then.
And it's also a payment for nothing. It's payment for buying a lottery ticket. So it's very different from something that you know, it's not like he won a $10,000 prize in a pie baking contest.
Or humanities. Yeah, and in some of the early drafts, that was one of the riffs was that he was going to misunderstand that as, but that wasn't really too productive. So,
the thing that he ends up spending this money on is his garden.
It's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, he has gone to this fancy party at one of his daughter's school friend's house, and they have this majestic garden, and it has this central element in it, which is quite popular in all the bourgeois homes. And I feel like I should leave it to you to describe what this is.
Well, you know, the story had its origin. I had a dream during this period in Syracuse when our kids were little. And in the dream, I got up, went to a non-existent window. Our house didn't have this window, but it looked into the backyard. And there were four young women who that I, in the dream logic, knew to be from third world countries. They were suspended on a line that went right through their heads, like literally right in the left side and out the right side. They were wearing these beautiful white smocks, and they had long, beautiful black hair. And they were not unhappy. They were sort of just there talking, a little chatting. And on either side, there were these kind of big A-shaped sort of supports.
Like the sides of a swing set.
Exactly, exactly right. Yeah, and I just looked at that and I was like, and the thing that was so weird about the dream was instead of going, oh my God, call the police, the guy in the dream went, oh, I'm so lucky, I finally did it. And so the feeling was that this was something that everybody had, and this guy had been sort of screwing up by not being able to provide it.
When you say the guy in the dream, you're talking about the you figure in the dream.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I can remember the feeling of my hands on either side of the window frame and looking, then turning and looking in a dream, looking back at my wife and thinking, oh, we're so lucky. What did I do to deserve all this good luck? So usually, you know, when you have a dream, it's not writable. It's, you know, hey, there's a penguin masturbation conference. That's really cool. And then you wake up and go, no, that's not. But this one was deep. And it was especially that the jarring reaction to what he was seeing versus what he was seeing. So I just kind of let it sit there for a while, and then after a couple of weeks, I started writing it up. It was a long, I think a 12 or 13 year process of finishing it, mainly because that image was so weird and so troubling. And it, on one level, it's obvious. It's sort of a, you know, we oppress the third world thing. But if that's all it was, then the story wouldn't be sufficient. So part of it was just sort of, well, what else is the story about, and kind of keep churning that up.
Well, it feels like in large part what that story is about is trying to figure out how and what to teach your kids.
Right. Yeah. And in that case, you know, and this is true somewhat of me too, which is in the anxiety about your possible shortcomings, it takes a certain amount of guts to stick to the real principles, which is, yeah, we don't have any money, but we're good people. To thine own self be true. You know, you're like, yeah, that's true. However, also, we're going to get a new car. You know, you sort of want to shore the thing up where you can. You know, you want to be both, you know, have the moral high ground and have some nice stuff. And so I found that often in my case, you know, you imagine sort of depression parents who say, well, Billy, we don't have anything, but we've got our Lord, you know, or something. And my thing was a little less principles. Well, we do have our Lord, but we don't have to apologize to anybody because we also have a brand new Nissan, you know. So I suspect I'm not alone in that inclination. And he, you know, was sort of even worse than I was.
When in your life have you felt the most economic pressure?
Well, I lived out here in L.A. for a while, and that was probably the most comical economic pressure. But I didn't have any responsibilities. But I remember I worked as a doorman in Beverly Hills here, and we had gotten on. It was supposed to be a big deal because you got all these tips. But then the place had this policy that said you don't need any tips because you're on salary. But the salary was $4 an hour. So it was kind of this, you know, capitalist shell game. But I remember, you know, we didn't have any money and living with a group of people and just kind of going, well, it's going to be a long day. And I have $2, which is not enough to buy lunch, going in the fridge and seeing everyone else's food and like, yeah. And then every so often go, well, a potato. Nobody will mind. So there was a time where I actually took uncooked potatoes to work as lunch. So that was sort of low.
Multiple occasions?
Yeah, yeah. Whenever I could find them. I thought, like, I can't take their ham. That would be uncool. But a potato, you know, anybody. So then, and then the big trick was you'd go to work, and if you could manage to get, you know, sometimes people tipped you anyway. And if they did, it was like the pastrami truck would come and it was $3.80 or something. So if you could accrue the, you know. I've never had true financial, you know, where, like, if I'd called my parents at that point, they would have helped. But
they would have sent you some potatoes.
Yeah, yeah. They have so many potatoes. They were, like, so potato rich. Yeah. But I think that's one of the, you know, as a fiction writer, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to freeze to death. You have to go outside when it's 20 and go, and then you extrapolate. And so, you know, there's kind of a shtick in among writers, which is kind of like that old Monty Python sketch about we used to live in a lake, you know, so you exaggerate your hardships. And I, as I get older, I'm like, I've never had any actual hardships. But they're not paying you to have hardships. They're paying you to have imaginative empathy.
But I don't know. I was just reading this. I was reading this article in the New York Magazine the other day about how high school is terrible. It's the worst. I mean, breaking news. But part of the point of this article is that in your late adolescence, certain parts of your brain are just exploding with growth and other parts haven't quite grown. And part of the effect of that is that your experiences are dramatically more vivid and well-remembered through the rest of your life in a way that no other part of – that is not true of any other part of your life.
That's really interesting. So it's a chemical or neurological phenomenon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That makes it so that, you know, in my case, I still have really strong feelings about Tony, Tony, Tony. You know?
Right. No, I also heard somewhere that there's some neurochemical thing that I think is as you get older, this chemical diminishes. And that's the chemical that tells your brain how to process time. So this would explain why when, you know, the childhood summers kind of go on forever. And then as you get older, that there's that phenomenon of the calendar pages flipping. So I love that idea that your you know, your experiences are basically neurochemical. And I think also, especially when you're that age, offenses seem to really loom large. You know, places where someone disrespected you or said that incredibly mean thing that that you're still remembering 60 years later and trying. It's the whole Citizen Kane thing, I guess.
You have a few kind of kids and adolescents in the book that I really enjoyed reading your writing from their perspective. In the first story in the book, it's called Victory Lap. The two narrators are both adolescents, one a boy, one a girl. There's this part that I was hoping you could read from the girl's perspective. This is before any of the action in the story starts to take place.
Oh, yeah. So this girl's kind of a sweetheart, kind of an optimistic sweetheart. And so this is her, I guess, her philosophical statement. Or just before this, she said that each of us is a rainbow. That's her. You know. So, but as far as that rainbow idea, she believed that. People were amazing. Mom was awesome. Dad was awesome. Her teachers worked so hard and had kids of their own, and some were even getting divorced, such as Mrs. Dees, but still always took time for their students. What she found especially inspiring about Mrs. Dees was that even though Mr. Dees was cheating on Mrs. Dees with the lady who ran the bowling alley, Mrs. Dees was still teaching the best course ever in ethics, posing such questions as, can goodness win? Or do good people always get shafted, evil being more reckless? That last bit seemed to be Mrs. Dees taking a shot at the bowling alley gal, but seriously, is life fun or scary? Are people good or bad? On the one hand, that clip of those gauntish, pale bodies being steamrolled while fat German ladies looked on chomping gum. On the other hand, sometimes rural folks, even if their particular farms were on hills, stayed up late filling sandbags.
There's something about the adolescent blitheness that actually sort of infects almost all of your characters.
Yeah, well, that was me. That was just me at that age. I had a big Ayn Rand, and I thought, and Khalil Gibran, I just thought, I don't know why people have so much trouble in life, All you had to do is do the right thing, which is what I plan to do in the rest of my life. And then,
How did that feeling change for you?
Just by getting bonked by things in life. But then even before that, I'd been in Asia. I worked in the oil fields, and that was huge too, because I didn't suffer at all over there. I had a great time. But, I'd never been out of the States and would be dropped into these, pretty impoverished places. Even a lunkhead like me could sort of see that there was some, even to call it disparity would be, it was just like cosmic disparity, these people who were happy and working hard and just for no money. I walked by this building I was out drinking, in Singapore, and kind of stumbled home at night, and about midnight, 2 a.m, there's a big hotel going up, and in the foundation, there's this motion, like this crab-like motion. So I stopped and looked down, and it was all these, old Malaysian women who were on the night shift, and they were basically, wearing sarongs or whatever and barefoot and cleaning out boulders by hand, So that was a real, a huge moment for me to look down and go, oh, you are 23, basically don't know much, you're drunk, and you got $800 in the bank or whatever it is. That's interesting. They are 87 years old. There's no money in the bank. They're carrying rocks by moonlight. What did you do, Ayn Rand part of me said, well, you worked hard. I'm like, no, I didn't, or you're someone who understands that power is beauty. And you look down at those women, you went, yeah, I'm not quite buying that. So those kind of things, gradually they kind of just complicate your worldview, I guess.
So then how do you be, when you get to that place, how do you find some measure of peace and happiness besides taking an annual vacation to the same place?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I think maybe that kind of peace and happiness is overrated. To be a little mindful of that stuff and agitated by it isn't such a bad thing. But also, that's a part of it's just human stupidity. You think, well, I didn't do it, or you think, I really am concerned about those things. Well, now I've got to go do an interview, So on one level, that's pretty scary. But also maybe just that, it's funny because maybe one manifestation of a materialist viewpoint is that you think economic disparity is the end game, whereas in fact, if I wanted to really be honest, I'd say, well, there have been times when I was poorer, but had my head on pretty straight, or you know, like, well, you turn to Jesus and the poor will be with us always. So I think I think most things, it seems to me, morally, your job is to keep four or five ideas going at once. So the idea that, you know, we all know the person who won't enjoy anything because life is so cruel, you know, and that person, that's an egotistical standpoint somehow, it feels to me. You also know the person who enjoys everything and doesn't even care, you know, that's not good either. So I think to kind of keep all that in the air at the same time and then realize that the only way you can actually really morally act is one action at a time on one particular day with one particular person. And so maybe your biggest moral imperative is to bring all your energy to that moment rather than distracting with a bunch of theoretical what-ifs, something like that. I don't know.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the writer George Saunders. He's won acclaim for his short story collections, including Pastoralia and Civil War Land in Bad Decline. His new book is called 10th of December. Do you have a hard time as a grown-up?
Yes.
The last story in the book is about a young sort of fat, dorky boy who imagines himself as a hero, and an older man who is thinking about ending his life or planning to end his mm-hmm. life, and the intersection between their two lives. Do you ever find yourself as a grown-up having a hard time getting to a place where you can go down paths in your imagined world to make fiction? Because I know that it's almost impossible for me now as a grown-up to think of anything that isn't actually happening.
Oh, I don't find that hard, actually. I love it. I love the chance to write a kid, maybe because of what you mentioned earlier about the neurology of memory. But when I think back to grade school in Chicago, it's just incredibly deep stuff. And, I mean, the situations and the time and the people, but also I can kind of remember my thought processes pretty well. So that to me isn't so difficult. But also, you know, it's mechanical in a sense, because you don't go into a piece like that so that you can remember childhood but you're kind of just trying to make a paragraph that works. And then a paragraph that works also causes problems. It causes, you know, if you write a paragraph that convinces the reader that there is this older guy who has cancer who needs to die, he feels like he needs to get out of this quickly. If you do that convincingly, then, you know, in narrative terms, then you need to produce something that interrupts that. So in a certain way, that all of this kind of remembering and so on comes from a fairly strictly mechanical need that the story produces day to day. It's maybe one of the wonderful side benefits of fiction is you had no idea when you got up that you were going to recreate the way you used to play fake hockey in your kitchen in 1968. But the story says you need 2 minutes of a kid thinking, you know, and suddenly you get the opportunity to go back and revisit that.
It seems like also maybe the experience of going down a path narratively in fiction and sort of putting yourself emotionally in a state and trying to solve that problem so that it's something for the reader is not all that wildly different from that physical act you described in nonfiction of sending yourself to the crack bridge.
It's a great observation. It's literally the same thing. You sense, you know, in your 360 degrees of mental space, you sense a forbidden door. And your first thing is to turn away from it. And then the craftsman in you says, nah, come on, turn towards it. And that often happens in fiction for sure. And in fact, it's funny because as you're doing it, you'll find structural ways to kind of put a tarp in front of that door. You know, you often the best solution is the one that you've meticulously almost roped out of the story. So when I teach, I have this idea called avoidance moments, and you'll see it all the time in young fiction writers and old fiction writers. You'll get to the emotional hot spot of a story, and every reader in the world knows you got to go there, and the writer will feel it and go, oh, no, that's too much pressure. And often they'll put in a narrative break, you know, or they'll put in a spaceship or some kind of funky technical, like a flashback to 1846 or something. And so they'll do almost anything. Your subconscious will do almost anything to avoid going to the deepest place there is, and it will actually mechanically do it in the story throughout. Sometimes the language will just fall apart, or there'll be an improbable. I had one story I remember where something really intense and uncomfortable and sexual was supposed to happen, and This was in some kind of a cabin in the woods, that, and we'd been told there was no electricity. And just as the thing was about to happen, the phone rings. And you're like, wait a minute, there's no phone. You know, so that's – it's an interesting – I think it's a natural kind of thing that the creative imagination will do when you get to something that's too hot for it to handle in that revision. It's not ready for it, so it just puts up a to-be-completed sign over it in some funny mechanical way.
A few years ago, I think shortly after the last time you were on our show, you got a MacArthur grant.
I did?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, I know, right?
I'll look into that.
Yeah, you should get your accountant to call them and check in about that check. Does that come with any, like, is there any important secrets we should know about getting a MacArthur grant? Like, do you get a special hat? Are you sworn to defend the governor of Kentucky?
Well, your ego swells up. That's one thing to watch out. No, you know, it's actually one of the amazing things about it is the guy from there calls you and says, he says, are you sitting down? And then he says, you got this thing and you should know there are absolutely no commitments. And there weren't. It was 5 years and the money showed up. And
were you okay with not putting commitments, with not adding your own commitments to it?
You know, I know just what you're saying, and I kind of was okay with it. I think I'd gotten to a point in my life where I thought, well, that's weird, but okay, that's so – and actually, you know, the gratitude that you feel is really something. And so I just kind of felt like if you get good luck, your job is to live up to it. That's it. And but part of living up to it, especially as a writer, is to not get too crazy. Like don't – just stay – keep writing the way you were. That's why they gave it to you. But, you know, what was interesting was psychologically it felt – I mean, you know, we talked about the money thing. It felt like the ceiling lifted just a little bit. And suddenly I noticed actually that I had an internal flinch whenever I'd use a credit card. You know, that moment where you're waiting for it to come back, you know, that went away a little bit. Or, you know, if you – when you were – it's silly stuff. Like when you're calculating a tip, you'd go, eh, we'll err on the side of more, you know. And then – so that was one psychological thing. And also that something really weird about the approval from afar made me really want to do better. Like, wow, those people that I don't know thought well of me. So in my work, I'm going to err on the side of the bolder choices. And now it's kind of weird that something like that should be necessary for you to feel that way. But I'm just telling you, it did happen, you know. So it was kind of sweet, you know, that the money was wonderful and appreciated. But then the real benefit, and I think you can see it in this book, actually, was that I thought, well, all right, there's some people I don't know think that I'm a good writer, then I should really try my best to do it and to live into their vision of me, which is maybe the best effect of the whole deal.
Did you redo your yard?
Well, but I can't talk about that. Actually, I redid it with 17 jet skis. kind of a modern art thing.
Well, George, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Bullseye.
It's a great pleasure. You're a great interviewer.
Thank you. George Saunders' hilarious and wonderful new book is called The 10th of December. What kind of flower is Maria Bamford?
I think I may be the orchid of comedy.
I'll talk to Maria after a break. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. You can follow Bullseye on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/Bullseye with Jesse Thorne and click like. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Comedian Maria Bamford is sensitive. You can see it in her characters on stage. When she adopts a character's voice, she cuts straight to deep feelings, the kind we usually keep hidden. When she voices a belligerent bully, you feel right away what's most awful about their bullying, but you get the bully's pain, too. In her new special, The Special Special Special, she performs at home as her parents watch from her living room chairs. Her pug wanders around in the background. And even in front of her parents, Maria's unafraid to go deep into her own issues, including her hospitalization last year for depression. But here's the great part about all of this, if it feels like too much to handle. Maria is also one of the funniest people in the world, just super, super, super funny. Here she is from the special, 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 with her parents laughing as she describes her ultimate online dating profile.
I was on eHarmingMe as well as Attach.glom. And those ones were, I cast a wide net. I said I was a little more active and flexible than I truly am, you know. Hey, guys, I can pull on a sparkly gown and go to the steakhouse, or I can strap us both to a boxcar and ride the rails. No, I work hard. I play harder. I'll rest and I'm dead and I'm never gonna die. Got your passport? Let's go parasailing, biking. My current ad reads, I can wear the same outfit for 5 days, or I can crouch naked in the shower and get real small. I sleep hard.
Dream harder!
I'm on a roller coaster with my dogs and Beyonce. I will wake up when it's time! Got your library card? Let's go pay off some of my fines. Because I do not borrow books. I lease. I like there to be a public record of me stealing something.
Oh, Maria. Thanks for the laughs, Jesse.
Welcome back to the show, Maria. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
I think what I love about that bit, I mean, there's just some wonderful jokes in that bit, but it is such a vivid illustration of when we are trying to connect to someone else. I mean, romantically in that sense, so the stakes are real high, but so just high. In general, the lengths we will go to try and present ourselves in the right light.
Right. But yeah, that when I'm trying to do that less, you know, just because it's so useless in the end, because then they're like, wait a minute. You were that way for about 24 hours and then suddenly you fell over. You tipped over and you never got up.
Are you saying that your ability to stand upright is all a facade?
It's a, I don't know, it comes and goes.
You know, one of the things is that as a stand-up comedian, you have to have an external focus in your work. You have to be thinking about what the audience thinks is funny and what the audience doesn't think is funny. And that just has to be part of what you do, or else you won't work, right?
Well, I what's most important to me is what I think is funny. Like that is most important to me, because I have to say it over and over again. So even if somebody doesn't get it or whatever, I mean, I would like to reach all, but, you know, sometimes I think I may be the orchid of comedy, where you have to have this, you know, certain temperature in the room and then get the right amount of moisture, and it takes years to really get a bloom going. But once you do, they're so beautiful. Oh, it's got too hot.
Have you learned over the years about what the particular, you know, hothouse temperature and humidity settings are that leave you successful, or do you still go into a room and you can't predict whether it's going to work or not?
Well, yeah, I mean, you never know. But I have rooms in L.A. that are, you know, it's all nice young hipsters in their tight pants and their pointy shoes. And, you know, it's very warm. Or yeah, any sort of theater environment I seem to do well in. And then, you know, places where, you know, the Comedy Store or Laugh Factory, improv on, I would say, most nights, it's going to be a tougher sell, you know. So I would hope, you know, of course, I think that's true, just because I've been to those places and gone, oh, this is not what they've come for. They have come for something entirely different. And I am so sorry.
Have you had situations where your expectation upon, you know, stepping into the wings or surveying the crowd before the show was, oh, no, this is not what they signed up for, and then had the opposite experience happen.
I've prejudged people by their covers. You know, if they go, oh, it's got a bunch of guys in their military uniforms, and I go, oh no, but it turned out they were super supportive. Or you never know. And sometimes people who say they really love what you do kind of can have too much to drink, and then they start saying your jokes as you're saying them, and that's a champagne problem. The champagne's dribbling far too fast to my mouth, Jesse. I need to have some sort of assistant help me with it. I can bomb anywhere in Los Angeles tonight.
Why did you choose to do your act for your big hour-long special in front of your parents?
Number one, I love my parents, and any time that I can spend with them is a bonus.
So you were thinking of, like, the makeup chair just around the set at the craft services table. That would just be fun.
It'd be fun, and they're an easy laugh. Also, I seem to do better in front of them when they are an audience and not just my parents. I told my dad I was working on some bits, and on the phone, my dad was like, is that the end? Are you done? So... when they have to sit beneath me, you know, in a chair and I'm up and lit somehow, the stuff seems to go off a lot better. I thought it'd be fun and more intimate and I wasn't feeling so good last year, and the idea of like doing a giant 300, okay, let's say 50, 100 theater, you know. And getting that all organized sounded like, oh, let's just and I like the idea that it is, you know, who do you strive for, or who do I strive for the most, you know, is trying to get the approval of people that I love. And then you see at the end that they're not that impressed. Like, my mom just totally goes, oh, I just don't think she should have gone after Paula Deen like that. I mean, you know, they just totally... No, but they are genuinely very supportive and,
There is something nice about a structured interaction with your parents.
Yes.
Where they have to listen to you.
Yes.
Where you have all the power because you have the microphone.
Yep.
And where their experience with you is going to be exclusively built around the thing that you do best.
Yes. That is, I mean, I think that's why I did stand-up, is so that, you know, because around the dinner table when I was a kid, my dad would say, hey, this is Maria's turn, Chuck. You know, I'd get to have 3 minutes or something at the table, but I would never get to have the time because it would always be interrupted by the heckles of my sister and mother. It's totally controlled environment.
There is something about them that is very, you know, northern Midwestern. And you have a wonderful bit that's in the special and on your most recent CD that I guess you would call Joy Whack-A-Mole.
Right.
Let's take a listen to that.
Mom, Amy had her baby. Oh, that is great news, honey. I mean, it's not the greatest news for the 600,000 kids in foster care, but if she wants a fresh one, oh, jeez. Everybody wants one that looks like them. It's so selfish. Mom, I'm doing a show tonight. Sweetie, I got a joke for you. A friend of mine, she's so funny. She said you could use it. She, coincidentally, she was in foster care. She had been airlifted out of the Sudan in the late 90s because she had been bearmed and belegged by the Janjaweed, the horseback militia. She loved to do stand-up, but she can't. And it's really a hospice situation. It's just a matter of time. But the priest comes in, and he asks her, would you like us to light a candle for you in the chapel?
She says, sassy as you please, teletyping through her eyelids. Well, how many candles you got? Because so many horrible things have happened to her and keep happening. Sweetie, have a good show tonight. What you do is so important.
It seems like there's something really important when you live in like a frozen nightmarescape for 5-6 months out of the year in keeping the most even of keels.
Yeah.
And I think your Northern Europeans who later migrated to the north of the Midwest of the United States, like that is a really valued thing. Like just you can't get too high or too low when it's negative 20 outside.
Right. You've got to get along with everybody. And I was wondering about that because physically my family isn't like we don't touch each other that much or you give shoulder based hugs. Oh, why even hug? You know, what's the point? And I was like, well, I wonder why that is, because you guess you'd be in cozy, close environments. Maybe you wanted to have your own space. But my mom is very breezy. Like she can float through, you know, which I trying to write some stuff about that out. My mom, you know, how does she stay so cheerful? You know, listen, kid, you know, I mean, the stores are still open. You know, I mean, how bad can it be? But I get it. You know, I go to Subway, I get myself a turkey sub. I think, what's going on here? Because I'm a curious kitty. And you get those packaged apple slices, but it's catch as catch can. And I think maybe we don't have to figure it all out, you know? Your father lost confidence after the prostate surgery, and I said, why don't you go get yourself something? He went out, bought himself the used Dodge Caravan, and then we were back in business. Sweetie, I got to upload all my Weight Watchers points into the cloud. Like, she's just buoyant. She's a very buoyant person. Like, she's just...
She's an MFT, right? Marriage and Family Therapist?
Marriage and Family Therapist, yeah.
My mother-in-law is an MFT. I've been with my wife forever, so I've spent a lot of time at their house. And it's a very interesting thing to have a trained, a medically trained family operator.
Yeah.
In the household. How do you think that affected your life?
Well, she didn't get therapized until after I graduated from college.
Oh.
Too little, too late, Marilyn. It is great because we do have, and my mom has had episodes of mania and anxiety and depression. So that's something I share with her, and you know, just things that everybody's okay with, and my mom's obsessed with Jesus. My sister's obsessed with spirituality. I'm obsessed with the idea that there is no comfort. And anyways, it was a great Christmas. And you know, it's funny because we all try to have similar interests, even though we disagree with each other. It's everyone's passionately interested in their point of view.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Maria Bamford, is a comedian and actress with a new stand-up special that's daring and brilliant and really funny. It was taped in front of a live audience of two, her parents. It's called The Special, Special, Special. Your last CD was called Unwanted Thought Syndrome.
Yes.
Which is a condition from which you suffer.
Oh, so I don't have it as much anymore because you can get cognitive behavioral therapy and that can kind of take care of it.
And you talk about bipolar and your depression on this special. Was there a point when you decided that you were going to talk about that stuff on stage?
Well, I mean, I think I am one of those comedians. I like the feeling of like, oh, people might be uncomfortable. A little bit of that I think I do like. But also, I think because it was such an intense experience, like, well, what else am I going to write about? Or at least to me, that's what I enjoy about creativity is like writing something I'm super mad about or super... like one thing I was so, it's just, so many things happened that I was just super surprised by, even in myself, that, I come from a family that, is very supportive of mental health services, things like that. I've been in therapy since I was like 11 when I started having, couldn't sleep at night. And I would not go into the hospital, so it was like, that is insane. Like, I'm this West Coast groovy yoga, hey man, take care of yourself. And I wouldn't do it because it was too embarrassing. It was just too, I felt too ashamed.
There's part of it that's about stigma, but I think, hospitalization for mental health problems is kind of scary just in general.
Right, right. But I think the thing that puts an even more layer of scariness is that it's ashamed, don't tell anyone, here or something, that it's it is different from different kinds of healthcare where people come to your room with balloons and things like that. Of course, you can't bring in balloons into the psych ward because there are many people who are creative and might find something to do with them. It is disturbing, but it's also super safe. I was planning to hurt myself. And to put that responsibility on friends and family to go, hey, can you do a 24-hour vigil on me? Just keep an eye out. Ooh, I don't feel good. Oh, I'm still here. That's ridiculous.
You have a bit on the record about a very well-meaning friend who comes to visit you.
Yeah.
and gets, just gets the whole thing wrong, basically. Gives you some sort of destructive advice. And I wonder, at what point you processed that conversation to the point where you could figure out something that was funny about it, where you were at when it was happening, if you were able to have external, if you were able to look upon it from an outside of it, or when you realized, I can exert some control over this by thinking about what part of it is a joke.
I think that was months later. I just didn't feel good. And in retrospect, I felt very, I was totally kind of out of it at the time. But I remember feeling really upset that this person thought, that I was doing the wrong thing. Like, they're like, you gotta, I can do the bit. May I?
Yes, of course.
I do love
Yes,
to do
of
the
course.
Maria, this place is just negative energy. You've got to get out of here. Right, right. That's what I... But the thing is, they 5150'd me, and they took away my shoelaces, and my brain is going off like an untethered jackhammer, and I can barely hear it. You know what? Get out into nature, Go up to Big Sur. Exactly. That's what I said. Like, slowly into the surf. Can't find me. No muss, no fuss. I talked to my spiritual advisor, and he said people who commit suicide, that sometimes they just need to go on to the next level, the next world. And so I guess I've just come in to say goodbye. Okay. You're horrible. And please come visit me tomorrow. And you're horrible. And if you could bring me a 20-ounce Diet Coke in a bottle, because if I hold it next to my face, it brings some sense of cool. And they won't let us have cans. Why don't you bring that little Maria Sunshine over to the children's hospital? You wouldn't have to make a wish if you believed. And I think it was a way to comfort herself, too, to say, if you died, it's meaningful. And, that it's a spiritual thing, and now you're going to be I get it, but it was just like so much like, I'm abandoned, sort of like, well, you're making this choice to be sick, and maybe that's an LA thing, but I do think that's a part of our culture to distance yourself from any illness by saying, they got sick because they're idiots, on some level, or
but I won't. I won't, you know, bad things won't happen to me. You know, so like I had a friend who had died of cervical cancer and everyone was like, well, how did she, I mean, did she know, you know, like trying to figure out the map of like, how can I not have that happen to me? Like, how could I kind of blame that person so it won't happen to me?
I want to ask you one about one last thing, which is that you talk about all these scary things in your life, in your special. You know, I mean, from committing yourself to, you know, your relationship with your parents that you're talking about in front of your parents. I feel like maybe the scariest thing that you talk about is your dog dying.
Oh, yeah. That's a bummer.
You had a real sweet dog named Blossom.
Blossom, the awesome pug.
Who she appeared on our show one time via webcam, as I recall.
She's very talented.
And Blossom died in a home accident.
Home accident, and it wasn't. Involuntary manslaughter. I didn't plan. I didn't leave a trap. It was more neglect. I removed a ramp that went from the house to the backyard, and I just didn't have it in my head. Oh, she's going to try to go out that ramp, and she'll fall the approximately 4 feet and to her death, which is she was 12 years old, and so and it was a super hot day. It's about 110 degrees or whatever, and it was just awful, you know, but I tried to talk about it because it was so, I just felt so awful about myself. And the joke is then that, of course, she would have forgiven me.
Listen, I grew up in Berlin in the 30s, you know, where we could and shit on each other with impunity. There's no big deal. Now you lift a leg at a dog park, everybody's up in arms, you know. Had the shoe been on the other foot, pressed my Lady Beretta and been shot in the head. You know, I know you would have forgiven me. And anyways, within 48 hours, as it has been documented, as a pug, I would have eaten you.
And which is true. Pugs have eaten their owners after their deaths. But also, yeah, well, I Googled online, like, I killed my pet. I killed my loved one. And just heart-wrenching stories of just, like, moments of distraction and people who obviously love their child, love, you know, humanity, love dogs, animals, you know, and they just, you know, you know, whatever horrible, unspeakable, shameful thing you've done, Google it. Sunday has done is exactly what you've done or worse and is currently on a book tour. You're never alone because I typed in, I killed my beloved into an internet search engine. Up came a chat room with a young lady who had sadly left her baby in a hot car. Oh, my God. We're all doing the best we can. And sometimes it is not that good. It could happen to anybody. And I mean, I don't know. Maybe it is me, though. But I felt terrible just, you know, because this is a dog that I... You know, she was my best friend, and there's just nothing worse that I could imagine without living in a war zone, it was such a bummer, terrible.
So it is a terrible thing. I will take this opportunity to say that, you know. It's not a your fault situation. It's a horrible things happen in the world situation. But there's something significant to me.
I should have worn
that.
I wore helmets. Put a little helmet on her.
There's something significant to me in that you chose to bring that to the stage because it's not an easy sell to an audience.
Yeah.
It's the hardest sell there could basically be. to an audience. And I wonder if you have a feeling about why you wanted to do that.
Well, I think the same thing. Like, I just think, it's kind of, I mean, for me at this point, which I feel sort of embarrassed by, it, like, I have a very supportive fan base, so it's a pretty easy sell for me. You know, people are like, we're happy for you, or you want to be loving. But also, like, that was something I just thought, no one could tell me about it. Like, it was one of those experiences, like, I tried to find on Amazon, like, something of, like, I did this horrible thing that caused the death of, you know, like a book about that. And I couldn't seem to find it. But then once I started talking about it, and that's another reason I talk about things, so that people talk about it to me. It's just like, you shouldn't have to deal with that by yourself.
Maria, you're number one. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
No, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm sorry I was late and confused.
Maria Bamford's amazing new special is called The Special Special Special. You can find it from her website, mariabamford.com, or you can find it online at chill.com, where you can buy it for streaming or download for an extraordinarily low price. Every week on our show, we close with a recommendation from yours truly. It's The Outshot. I'm older than I used to be. I'm married, and I have a son who just last week we dropped off at nursery school for the first time. As time passes, I feel less and less like my own discrete entity. When you're married with a kid, it's tough to tell where I ends and we starts. My borders bleed into my wife's and my child's, and I'm part of a family, not just a guy all by himself with his own priorities and desires and will and all that. But sometimes I catch a moment where the family stuff and love stuff and baby stuff doesn't quite fade away, but maybe it's not quite so pressing. Just a little time to myself. That's when I think of a William Carlos Williams poem that I love. It's called Danse Russe. He writes about peacefully enjoying the moment before his family wakes up. Sitting in his own quiet room. The sun is just rising, a flame-white disk in silken mists above shining trees, is how he puts it. And that's when he takes off his clothes and does a funny naked butt dance. His language is a bit more elegant, of course, what with being a legendary poet and all. I, in my north room, dance naked, grotesquely, before my mirror, waving my shirt round my head and singing softly to myself. I am lonely, lonely. I was born to be lonely. I am best so. Somehow this little indecency, this little self-indulgent goof, doesn't feel, to me anyway, like a rejection of family or a spirited defense of me against the creeping tide of us. To me, it feels like a gleeful little highlight of how self fits into belonging, how me reinforces us. This is how Williams closes the poem. If I admire my arms, my face, my shoulders, flanks, buttocks against the yellow drawn shades, who shall say I am not the happy genius of my household? Yeah. Who shall say that? Bring them on. That's my outshot. That's it for this week's Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Our senior producer is Nick White. Our intern is Thomas Madison. Our interstitial music is provided to us by Dan Wally. Our theme music is Huddle Formation by The Go Team. Thanks to the Go Team and their label Memphis Industries for letting us use it. You can find this show and all past Bullseye shows for free at MaximumFun.org. You can also visit us on Twitter at Bullseye, on Facebook and SoundCloud, where you can share segments with your friends. I guess that's about it. And remember, All great radio hosts have a signature sign-off. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. With benefits kicking in as close as 100 miles from home, you can protect your travel plans whether you're driving across state lines or flying cross-country. Learn more at AllianzTravelInsurance.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.